You're listening to radio station KPFT HD2 channel. My name is Ray Hill. The name of the program is Execution Watch. We will begin with some music and be right back with the show. And we're back on. Professor Longmire, are you there?
Yes, I am.
All right. What do you see at your end?
All right. Right now there are four of us standing here on the corner. It looks to me like the witnesses for the media are right now entering the building. They've just walked in, and so you called it at the perfect time. Three witnesses for the media have just entered the building. Means if things proceed normally, in about a minute or so, we should see any witnesses for Elsie Taylor who are going to be witnessing entering the unit as well.
Well, I don't know. Are you anticipating witnesses for Elkie?
I don't know his case particularly, and so I don't know whether there will be witnesses for him or not. But if there are, they will be coming in very soon. Right now, it's a very quiet night compared to the most recent executions in one respect, because there's nobody here with a bullhorn shouting about Texas being murderers and another murder taking place. Often that's what happens here. As you know, Gloria Rubeck, who is usually here, she also has with her a megaphone.
And yeah, she has a permanent sound permit for the city of Houston, and she carries a speaker around her neck and speaks into
right.
a microphone. Yeah.
Yes. And it's a point of some disagreement among people who are here on the corner. Most of us believe that the presence here on the corner should be more prayerful and more solemn. Obviously, Gloria doesn't agree with that, and fortunately, we live in a country where people don't have to agree with one another, and you have the freedom of speech, and she exercises it when she's here. But it's a quiet night here, in a large part because Gloria's not here, and also there are only four of us. And so right now there is one correctional officer and three members of the Office of Internal Affairs who also are present. I do see there are now several people coming back across the street who are going to be witnessing for Elkie.
Okay.
I don't know them. I can only make them out vaguely because it's a bit dark tonight. It's darker than usual.
Well, we had daylight saving time to take a retirement.
Exactly right.
So I'll
tell you exactly how many are going in once they start climbing the stairs. They're just walking across the street now. And so it looks like there's one. Let me see, two people just walked in, but I know there are more than that. Some of them are coming up the stairs slowly. There's another three, four, five, six people going in. It looks like six people going in to witness for Elkie. And, of course, we do not know if there are any witnesses for the victim. Any witnesses for the victim would already have been in the main walls unit before I even got here at 5 o'clock.
Okay, Professor, we're going to, depending if you get any word, call Elizabeth's cell phone so that we can get you back on. And you and
okay.
I would like
we'll
you
do that.
When you come back the second time, I'd like to talk to you about your impressions about mental problems of people that are to be executed.
Certainly. Okay, I will call Elizabeth when I see witnesses coming back out.
Thank you, sir.
Sure.
And that was Professor Longmire. He's a professor out at... That was Professor Longmire. He's a professor at Sam Houston State University, and he is a frequent visitor to the vigil outside the prison when there are executions. And I am Ray Hill, back in the studio, and with me is Jim Skelton. And Jim, what does this case look like?
Well, first off, the guilt or innocence part was probably pretty well foregone conclusion. What had happened, this gentleman had been out of prison around 3 months. He had gone to prison for some burglary cases and been on parole and apparently had a drug habit. And there was a lady living with an elderly gentleman named Elkie Taylor. He was 65 years old, mentally retarded. And there was a, for want of a better phrase, a crack hoe, as they would call him, that was living with him. And are staying at the house some. And so what happened, Taylor and a friend of his with the name of Daryl Birdrow, I guess it's B-I-R-D-O-W, Birdrow, and they went by the house and smoked some crack with this lady. And while they're at the house, she claimed that she saw them looking around like they were wanting to steal something. She left the house, came back later, the front door was open to this gentleman's house, and the old gentleman was, they couldn't find him. The house had been ransacked, and she went in the back bedroom and found this 65-year-old retarded man. His hands and feet had been tied with rubber tubing, and he had been strangled to death with some coat hangers. And she saw these two guys, Elkie Taylor, and saw this guy, Daryl Birdrow, leaving the house with a pillowcase.
The victim had previously lived with his mother. He was a mentally handicapped person.
Right, exactly.
And his his mother cared for him as long as she was alive. And then when she died, he just kind of become one of those throwaway people on the streets of Fort Worth, Tarrant County. And I'd managed to find a roof over his head, but had... Perhaps some folks need a woman like a fish needs a bicycle, and he found one, and she was kind of a crack addict, and she'd run around with other crack addicts. So that kind of let those particular brand of rodents into the house. Now, was there any confusion about the guilt of Taylor versus his fall partner?
Of course, they both blamed each other. The problem is that Taylor was living with another lady. In fact, he's living with a prostitute, and he admitted to her that he did the killing. That's the problem. And number two, he signed a confession after he was caught.
Mm-hmm.
But then later on, when he realized, I don't know what came on, later on he then tried to claim the other guy did the killing. The other guy is now doing a life sentence. But his problem was, after the killing, he admitted it to his girlfriend, who was another crack lady and a prostitute, plus he also signed a written confession when he was caught. And that's kind of hard to get out of, the fact that you admit it, then, of course, later on you're going to blame somebody else for it. And that was the problem. There wasn't much of a question, at least in my opinion, about who did the killing.
And
But there was another instance where apparently shortly before that, he killed another elderly person in the home, and the killing was much the same as this one, using coat hangers and strangulation.
So there's a pattern
right to
be tracked.
And they got that other killing into evidence at guilt or innocence, and that was pretty well. Once that came in, it was all over.
What about the issue of the mental health?
Mental health was not brought up during the trial itself. What had happened, normally when somebody comes from kind of a poor or bad background, we have what we call a Penry instruction that permits the jury to hear about their disadvantaged childhood. In the trial itself, there's no evidence they ever discussed his mental health, ever. And what happened after he was convicted, after his case was affirmed by the Court of Criminal Appeals and affirmed on a state writ and a federal writ, is when the Atkins case came down. The Atkins case is that famous Supreme Court case that said it violates the Eighth Amendment to execute mentally retarded people.
Mm-hmm.
So after this came out, that's when the issue of mental retardation came. The problem is, when that issue came, at that point, all the direct appeals were over with. That means they had to go back into court on a state writ. And that's where the evidence of mental retardation came in. And here's the problem with that. Number one, when Atkins came out, and we've discussed that with the students in my class, when Atkins first came out, the Supreme Court just simply said it violates the Eighth Amendment to execute people who are mentally retarded. They left it up to the states to set up the procedure to resolve this issue. And I told my class back when it came out, unless they handled it at a pretrial hearing where only the issue of mental retardation alone came into evidence, unless they handled it that way, it would work against people who were, not against the death penalty, but for the death penalty. Because if you submit it as an issue at punishment, and they've already think he's done something hideous and realize he's retarded, it's going to incentive to give somebody the death penalty. And so that procedure was never set up by the legislature. Number one, they didn't define mental retardation. They didn't say when you brought it up. For example, if you're saying you're incompetent, you're entitled to a pretrial hearing on that. And also, normally, you're entitled to a jury on that issue. And these were never resolved by the legislature. So what happened? Our Court of Criminal Appeals needed to have some mechanism set up so they could kill more people, truthfully. And they set up a procedure. And here's what they've
made. In the absence of the legislature, then it is up to the courts then to come up with the definitions and the procedural guidelines.
Exactly, because the legislature did nothing. Yeah. So what happened, the Court of Criminal Appeals wrote an opinion in which they set up the guidelines of what, number one, define what mental retardation is. They never have decided yet how you resolve it except in a writ situation. Here's what they said about it. You can bring it up in a writ, but you're not entitled to a jury to resolve it. Because normally, like insanity, or when you're saying you're incompetent, you're entitled to a jury to hear it. They said you're not entitled to a jury. And here's how they define mental illness. They went back to a definition out of the mental health code, and they said, number one, you've got to have a subnormal IQ, usually below 60.
Mm-hmm.
Secondly, you've got to have adaptive behavior, evidence of some lack of adaptive behavior. And that means inability to dress, inability to catch a bus, inability to take care of yourself. And this has got to happen before the age of 18. So what that means is what they look at is any school records or any evidence in your childhood that indicates you're mentally retarded. Were you put in special ed classes? Did you have IQ tests? The problem here, Elka Taylor had one IQ test when he was in school and scored a 75 on it, mm-hmm. which is well above the numbers for mentally retarded people. Now, he took an IQ test after he was on death row, and he didn't, of course, he scored as being mentally retarded because once you're on death row, you can get really dumb if you have to get dumb to take a test.
Yeah, but the implication is that if you don't have any of that early record,
that's right,
you're SOL.
Exactly. You've got to have evidence of being mentally retarded, evidence of lack of what they call adaptive behavior, caring for yourself. It has to happen before the age of 18. And like I say, what they look at, the only time they've ever been successful with these cases are instances where children have been put in special ed, they've had IQ tests, they've been diagnosed as being mentally retarded, and that usually works. In this case, there's no evidence, all evidence.
Well, his previous prison record, he was on a unit as I understand, he was assigned to a unit consistent with people who have retardation problems, and he had such a classification. But none of that was before he was 18.
That's right.
So that doesn't, that's invalid. Well, so that we can discuss the appeal of this particular case, you have brought a guest.
I sure have. Real good lawyer friend of mine named Roland Moore has done quite a bit of work in federal court and has done a lot of work on post-conviction writs. And I asked Roland to kind of give us a summary of the problems you face when you have a direct conviction, and you have to go to the either state court or federal court.
Well, the whole idea of the writ of habeas corpus is, of course, more ancient than even the Bill of Rights, and it's even more ancient than the Magna Carta going back to 1215. But in recent years, it's become heavily regulated and very much more limited than perhaps it once was. And I think it's a very confusing area of law, not just for laymen, but also for lawyers also. Basically, what happens when someone is given a death sentence in Texas and taken to death row, he is appointed both an appellate lawyer to take his direct appeal to the Court of Criminal Appeals and also a lawyer on the writ of habeas corpus to take his his case directly to the Court of Criminal Appeals. And the direct appeal has to be done first, and assuming that's unsuccessful, which it almost always is, then the writ of habeas corpus lawyer has another year or so. And the difference between the two is that on an appeal, the lawyer who's doing the appeal is limited to the documents that are generated by the trial. That is the record that the court reporter has written down and all the documents that were filed with the clerk and nothing else. On the other hand, the lawyer who's in charge of the writ of habeas corpus can really go back and reinvestigate the entire case, interview any witnesses who weren't called at trial, do everything he can do to find out if something wasn't done by the trial lawyers. In other words, that's the perfect time you would hope that if there were something that was overlooked, if there was some evidence of innocence, or if there were important witnesses who could talk about the saving graces that the defendant might have had, that's the time to find them. Well, both those documents get filed with the Texas Court of Criminal Appeals. Once they're denied, the next step in the process is that the case goes over to federal court. Different lawyers are appointed, and they file a writ of habeas corpus in the lower federal court, in the federal trial court. And it's filed as a civil case, and the federal court hears that case. Now, there is a urban myth that once the habeas corpus action is filed, that this somehow allows the federal lawyer to go back and redo everything and find all the things that might have been overlooked in earlier stages of the case. Well, the fact of the matter is just the opposite, because the federal courts have taken a restrictive approach to these writs of habeas corpus once they land in the lap of a federal district judge.
Mr. Moore, for the benefit of our audience trying to keep up, a writ is the vehicle by which you take an appellate case to court out of sequence. Is that?
Well, it depends on what. There are several different uses of the writ of habeas corpus. One, the much more common use, is when someone is either denied bail or where the trial judge in the court, before the trial is ever had, puts bail at a unreasonably high amount. At that point, a lawyer can file a writ of habeas corpus and ask an appeal court to review the decision about either the denial of the bond or the placing of such a large amount of bond that no one could ever make it. That's
but
pre-trial.
But writ is just the vehicle.
But post-trial is where is the way that the whole case from day one gets reviewed by a lawyer, where there are no restrictions on what he can look into. He can go back and get new psychologists, new experts, see if there were people who weren't talked to, find out if a trial lawyer failed to call some witness who would have won the case, and bring that witness into court and have a hearing and have a trial judge decide whether or not a new trial should result.
And it's called habeas corpus, which is a Latin term meaning where is the body, right?
It means it means you have the body. Habeas means you have, and corpus means body. And the whole phrase is you're commanded to have the body, which means bring him into court and prove that he, and show that he deserves to be in custody, or let his lawyer show that he shouldn't be in custody.
So the body in question is the person who's locked up.
It's the person who's locked up. That's right. It's the.
Okay.
It's the.
It's well, the. I'm glad, it's, I'm glad you straightened
it's,
that out.
It's right. It's now, the corpus of the defendant.
Now, do you have any idea about how this case progressed?
Well, I think it went through the. It looks as though it went through the usual hoops. It had the wrinkle, as Jim pointed out, that there was the Atkins versus Virginia was decided by the U.S. Supreme Court, which allowed him to reopen and file a successive writ, which usually the courts are very negative about, and allowed him to try to show that he in fact qualified to be retarded and therefore exempt from the death penalty. And as Jim said, that effort failed. I think they want evidence of retardation when these claimants are younger, presumably, I guess, when they're too young to fake it. And I guess once you get old, people are more doubtful of you, especially when you've got a motive like this to try to save your skin from a date with the death penalty.
And this actually happened, the last stay happened on his way to the death chamber.
Mm-hmm.
And so now we're back on this, and I don't know, I guess they couldn't go back in time before he was 18 and examine how that happened. Jimmy, you have any idea about that?
Yeah, let me explain a couple of things. Basically, there were two sets of writs in this case. One is pre-Atkins, one is post-Atkins. Okay. Because what happened when his case was affirmed on direct appeal, they did a state writ and a federal writ, all of whom, which were denied. Then Atkins came out, which was the first time brought up the fact the Eighth Amendment prohibits people being executed. So what happened, they go back into state court on the state writ on the mental retardation issue. And what our Court of Criminal Appeals did, they kicked it back down to the trial court to have a hearing so the writ lawyers could develop evidence. See, here's your problem with this case. When they developed evidence with this case, they have to rely upon records that were made before he was 18 years of age to get in the definition of mental retardation, and you don't have a whole lot to work with. Now, normally what you do, if you're the writ lawyer at that point, you call family members, school teachers, people who knew him as a youth to show that he had lacked adaptive skills. But what really hurts you is you normally on somebody, regardless of where they live, they're normally going to have some IQ test when they're made in school or some test made in school. There's the big problem. And in this particular case, when they had the hearing on the writ, there was no evidence about his childhood not having adaptive good behavior. And, I mean, adaptive behavior. And the problem is there's really not much to develop because that cow's out of the barn at that point. And so they really had nothing to develop. So what happened when they had the hearing in state court and they developed the evidence of mental retardation, went back to the Court of Criminal Appeals, and they said they denied the writ.
Mm-hmm.
And as Roland pointed out, and one of the things we need to mention, a writ, you have a lot of you're also limited by this fact. The only errors you can bring up in a writ of habeas corpus have to be of constitutional dimension. So it's not like a direct appeal. For example, in a direct appeal, if there was an error, they violated a statute, I can bring it up on a direct appeal.
Sure.
But in a writ,
that error has to be preserved.
That's right. But in a writ of habeas corpus, you can only bring up a constitutional errors. And the most typical thing you bring up is that the lawyers didn't do their job at the trial level. That's 99% of all writs. And the problem is you only have so much to work with. And I've often said this before. You can be the greatest surgeon in the world to give you a pound of hamburger meat. You can't make Gina Little Bridge out of it. You work with what you got. You know, you can't make Sophia Loren out of bologna. And if you got bologna, there's nothing you can do. And these lawyers, when you go back to prove the mental condition of somebody when they're underage, have to rely upon documents. And if he scored high, like a 75, like he scored in this particular case, the only evidence they had of a test done as a youth, he is pretty well stuck. I don't care if he scored a zero when he became an adult in TDC. Yeah. It doesn't help any.
So this case is, because these issues continue to come up.
Yes.
And these issues, at this point, the only thing that might have saved Mr. Taylor is a grant of clemency from the governor's office via the Board of Pardons and Paroles. And that's a process. You submit to the board, and the board makes a recommendation to the governor, and the governor may or may not follow that recommendation. So that. And the other issue is that maybe one of these appeals would kick in at the last minute. And apparently that is not happening tonight or we'll know soon because they'll start the march across the street if it was completed, the process.
Here's a problem, if I can just interject this a second. The problem is the only thing that would save him now is federal court. State court's over with. And as Roland told me, and we've talked about this a lot because Roland and I have talked a lot about these cases, the test for getting into federal court from state court, you almost have to prove the trial judge was crazy. I mean, you have to prove that their decision they made at the trial level violated the Constitution based upon facts or upon the law. You have to basically prove that the people that tried him were nuts. And it's almost impossible to do that once you get into federal court. That's why you see so few of these federal writs granted, because what happened when Clinton was president, they passed some legislation that really restricted the right to review federal courts. And basically, it's what Roland said is exactly true. To get relief in federal court, you got to prove the trial judge was a complete nut and the lawyer was a nut. And that's going to be real hard to do on a federal writ. It's real, real limited. And I'd like Roland, maybe if you would, discuss a little bit about the requirements to get a federal writ granted, what you've got to do.
Well, what happens is that after the after the state court of criminal appeals denies the state writ, the lawyers who represent the death row inmate in federal court are very restricted. For instance, they can only bring up issues of federal constitutional law. Well, that lets out any matters that the state constitution might define as unconstitutional. So that means that these federal issues have to have been raised beforehand by the state court in order to get get any kind of relief. And generally, they do what's called defer to the state court. And once the state court of criminal appeals has decided that nothing unconstitutional was done, the federal courts really don't look behind that. And the standard is that whether there was a decision made that was contrary to or involved the unreasonable application of clearly established federal law. So if there's some ambiguous federal law, you're out of luck. Trying to prove that somebody on the Court of Criminal Appeals made an unreasonable application, as Jim said, is almost a standard of abnormal psychology as opposed to a standard of law. How could you possibly prove that the logic of a Texas judge was so rife with reasoning fallacies that he perhaps should be suggested to the attention of a psychiatrist? I mean, it's almost that absurd a standard, and of course it's cloaked in this very legalistic sounding language. So there are these substantive hoops that have to be jumped through, and then there's also this very restrictive 1 year requirement, which says that 1 year after the state decision is final, which generally means after the 3 months have expired that you have to appeal to the U.S. Supreme Court from the state judgment, you have 1 year to turn in your federal writ. And if you're a day late, then your client is not going to have his case reviewed.
If you're a day late, you run into a problem like the Texas Court of Criminal Appeals. If you got
That's
there,
right.
We close at 5 o'clock.
They slam the door in your face, basically. You absolutely have to be there. So that means unless there's some extraordinary circumstance, and this is now in litigation.
How much of this is political?
Well, the problem, and I don't know if Jim would agree with this interpretation, what you often hear from people who are in favor of these kinds of limitations was that the writ was being, of course, this is a horribly overused word, was being abused, and because prisoners were filing writs of habeas corpus about everything in the world, and since there was no limitation on how many writs could be filed, the staunch opponents of the death penalty would, when they lost a writ, would just file another writ. And eventually, they would be able to find a federal judge who would decide that something had been done improperly. And a large percentage of the convictions from the 70s through the early part of this decade were eventually thrown out.
Well, I remember in the Clarence Brantley case, which is a case close to the prison show here at KPFT, because Clarence was ultimately exonerated when it was discovered that the judge and the prosecutor had colluded in the destruction of evidence by flushing it down the judge's toilet, to be specific. We had exhausted all appeals at the time. Everything that could be done had been done. And Charlie Baird and Sam Houston Clinton were sitting on the Texas Court of Criminal Appeals. Mm-hmm. And we confronted them with the idea that evidence had been destroyed by the trial judge, and that the evidence existed was in the report from the Texas Department of Public Safety, which did the lab work in the case. So you had evidence that there was evidence, but you didn't have that evidence. The net result is they stopped the execution at the last minute for the third time, and they sent a plenipotentiary judge from the panhandle to come down and look at the situation. And he was an old redneck, famous old redneck, and I said, we're just dead in the water. when he came down here, his report said that obviously this was motivated by racism. It was the most racist thing he had ever seen. And I thought he was one of the most racist things that I'd ever seen. But
that's why he recognized it.
Right.
He knows a racist when he sees one.
And he just completely upset the cart so that then the Texas Court of Criminal Appeals had a vehicle to go back into this case. So actually, you can make up the rules? What?
Let me explain what you can do. There's a deal called a writ of coram nobis that's rarely ever used. The most famous case came out of San Antonio, a case called Alcorda.
Okay.
In which a man came home from work and found his wife making love to another man. And okay. He jumped into a pickup truck and began to stab. He killed his wife, but the guy doing the guilty stuff escaped.
Uh-huh.
So what happened, it was a sensational murder because she'd been stabbed a bunch of times. And this was back in the late 50s and early 60s. And what happened, the DA, a guy by the name of Leach, who was a DA in Bexar County, was going to seek the death penalty. And what happened, and it was one of those things, and this happens over and over again. The courts are pretty political. Judges have to be elected, and they don't get elected by turning murders loose. They get elected, as a matter of fact, we had a judge advertising her advertising page to be reelected. I put the rail killer to death. So that's a political slogan.
Sure.
She got beat, thank God. I mean, she can go join the rail killer. But nonetheless, they had this goofy judge. She was just in that same sort of thing.
Yeah.
They appoint this old drunk lawyer to represent Alcorda, and Alcorda kept telling his lawyer, looky, I caught my wife with another man. But back in those days, we had that thing. If
sure.
You recall back when we had that, you could kill it.
I remember that. It's all right to kill somebody if they deserve killing.
No, there was a paramour statute that if you caught your wife committing adultery, you could kill the guy but couldn't kill the wife. Well, he could have gotten a manslaughter or murder without malice back then. But what happened, the DA knew that when the police took the stand, they lied about the man being present. You would have thought if you heard the case, it was only the woman doing the conviction. He got the death sentence. And what happened, they exhausted all of their writs. And the guy who was present at the death, who was one making love to the man's wife, felt real guilty. He ended up getting hold of Freddie Saman. Because he said the guy's fixed to be executed, and the truth of the matter is he had a right to be mad that night because I was making love to his wife. And Saman didn't know what to do because all the writs were exhausted. And someone explained to Freddie, you do a writ of coram nobis, which means a new body of evidence that you have. It's like the same sort of thing as newly discovered evidence. And that's a vehicle you can use. And that's probably why I think that was using Clarence Brantley was the same sort of thing as coram nobis, a new body of evidence that shows guilt, as opposed to going back in under new law, which would be a new writ. And you can do it through a coram nobis.
So I mean, they no doubt had a legitimate right to reopen the case because somebody found a vehicle to do it. But I remember, and it was one of those situations that the lawyers were standing around pulling their hair out saying there's nothing more that we can do because nobody knew about this writ, about the destruction of evidence, but they obviously had left a trail.
And remember, Charlie Baird got defeated later?
Yes.
And Sam's dead now. Sam Houston Clinton's now dead. So our court ain't the same as it was back when Charlie Baird and Sam Houston
were on. No, as a matter of fact, it's the same as it was. It's going to be the same next year as it was this year because nobody up there got defeated in the election. Some judges got defeated, but not on the Court of Criminal Appeals.
Right.
Do you think that recent changes in Harris County are going to affect the amount of business and executions?
I think that what's going to change the only thing that will change the amount of business execution will be the change in the DA's office. Because again, as I've said before in this show, the reason we have so many death penalties out of Harris County is because of the DA's office. I think that juries here are no more meaner than the juries in Dallas County, Bexar County, other parts of the state. They just have more opportunities to give the death penalty than other jurisdictions. I think what will change, the judges really have very little impact on a death penalty case because the truth of the matter is, In 99% of death penalty cases, the only issue is future dangerousness in a punishment hearing. Because usually in cases like this, how in the world... The guilt is assumed.
Yeah.
And then what happened? You have a punishment hearing. And the judge has not much control because virtually everything comes in at punishment. Judges have little control over that. The ones who have control are the prosecutors. I think you have a call coming in.
Professor Longmire?
Yes, hello.
Are you there?
Yes, I am. Can you hear me?
Yes, we can hear you fine. What's going on?
Well, one of the witnesses has exited the building. It's the witness who is always present, and he's one of the Associated Press reporters. Some of the other witnesses should be coming out momentarily, but so far is the only person to have exited the building. I can see some correctional officers, staff, standing up by the main exit door. So it appears, yes, now all of the other witnesses are starting to come out. So the execution has taken place, and it was a bit longer than normal, but we don't, from the coroner, of course, we don't have any idea why that is. Sometimes it just takes longer to get all of the witnesses in the different witnessing rooms. Other times the offenders have a long final statement than others, and so sometimes they're delayed because of that. But right now it is clear that the execution...
That the process has been completed. I promised that we would have a little chat when you came back about the issue from your perspective of mental retardation, mental health in executions. Do you have any comments about that?
Yes, certainly. This is clearly a tragedy on both ends of this equation. Mr. Flack was mentally ill, and Mr. Taylor is mentally retarded, and the two of them ended up getting together. One killed the other. It's a violation of international human rights to execute someone who is mentally retarded. The state of Texas has once again shown its lack of concern for international law and gone forward and executed someone who even the prison system previously identified as mentally retarded. When Elkie Taylor was in prison for his first term of confinement for burglary, he was put on a unit for mentally retarded offenders. Tonight he was competent and well enough to execute. I don't understand it.
But we've witnessed this a couple of times recently.
Absolutely, and it's unfortunate because we believe that the Supreme Court solved that issue when they ruled it unconstitutional to execute mentally retarded. But at that time, Texas said, we have never executed anyone who's mentally retarded, so we don't need to worry about it. The Supreme Court did not define mental retardation and left that up to the state. And apparently having an IQ in the low 60s, maybe even lower, is not sufficient to qualify someone to be mentally retarded enough to excuse them and give them life rather than execute.
Professor, what is the survey research program at Sam Houston's college?
The survey research program at Sam Houston State University that I direct is a program that conducts surveys, usually statewide surveys, that are designed to ask people their attitudes about a variety of issues associated with crime and the administration of justice. I've conducted those surveys over the last 15, 20 years as director of the Survey Research Center. And it's meant to provide input and insight to the legislators and criminal justice policymakers about kind of the attitude of the people concerning issues that they're deliberating about making laws or passing laws concerning.
And that's an ongoing project, right?
Pardon me?
That's an ongoing project. You continue to do that?
Well, it depends now on funding. Previously, it was funded by a line of funding that we received from the Texas legislature. About 8 years ago, we stopped receiving those funds, and since that time, the surveys have been intermittent because I have not been able to secure funds to do statewide surveys as early as I had previously been able to.
Well, the same thing happened to the funding of that Italian fellow who used to do the policy stuff for the Texas Senate.
Although I believe that that particular decision was very politically motivated, mine was fiscally motivated. I think they got rid of the Tony Fabello's outfit because Tony Fabello wouldn't play their game. I don't think the decision to discontinue my funding had anything to do with me or my particular activities, but it was really more a matter of a shift in funding lines. And for whatever reasons, the dean of the college at that time decided not to continue funding the survey research program.
Well, I remember going to the legislature and seeing Tony's work being presented to the Senate. It was most helpful.
Absolutely. One of the wonderful things about that outfit when it was functioning was that it did provide politically neutral, policy-oriented research. The Texas Crime Poll has done the same. The Survey Research Program has done the same. In spite of my concerns about the death penalty, the research that I did consistently shows that citizens of Texas support the death penalty, and I would go to the legislature and testify to that effect. I also testified to the fact that Texans don't necessarily support the execution of mentally retarded people. They certainly didn't support the execution of juveniles, and so that information was also helpful to the legislature as they were deliberating on their issues. And so I think having research like that available for policymakers is invaluable. Unfortunately, with Tony Fabello's situation and the whole Criminal Justice Policy Council, that particular office was under the office of the governor.
Yeah.
So ultimately the governor decided he did not want it anymore.
Professor Dennis Longmire, we want to thank you for your contributions and helps with Execution Watch, and to give our regards to the other folks gathered there, and we will see you far too soon.
Thank you. I appreciate it. I wish I weren't here. I will not be here next week. I will be out of town. So hopefully Gloria will be able to make it up and be able to talk with you for the next two executions that are scheduled. I will miss both of those.
Hopefully one of them or both of them will result in a stay.
Hopefully, yes. Let's keep that hope alive.
Thank you, sir.
Very much, and keep doing the good work you're doing, Ray.
Thank you, Dennis.
Sure. Bye.
Bye-bye. And that was Professor Dennis Longmire of Sam Houston State University in Huntsville. Teaches in the School of Criminal Justice and is the director of the Survey Research Program. And like a lot of things that give accurate information to the legislature concerning criminal justice, the state is reducing their funds. Seemed to be a consistent pattern there, Jim.
Yeah.
All of this goes on. We can continue our conversation with Mr. Moore here with what's going on. Mr. Moore, why don't we pay more attention to the appellate courts and their responsibilities? Why is this not newsworthy or deserving attention? Everybody likes Perry Mason, but nobody likes who cleans up after him.
Well, I'm sure you know the old saying around criminal lawyers that criminals get convicted on the front page and their convictions get reversed on the back pages of the newspapers. It's a rare case that really attracts much attention. Issues are so abstruse, and it's conducted, and the analysis is conducted in such a rarefied legal way. I think that it's so complicated, it's hard enough for lawyers to understand, let alone laymen. I had a client who was horribly represented. I was convinced he was innocent. I filed a writ of habeas corpus. The trial judge decided that he deserved a new trial. She forwarded that finding to the Court of Criminal Appeals in Austin, and they very cynically sat on the case for 3 years until he was almost ready for parole, and then by a 5-4 decision granted his writ of habeas corpus. He was returned to Houston, and speaking of Perry Mason, of course, when you're young, you think every case you have is going to be like Perry Mason. We convinced the prosecutors that another man had done the crime, and found out who he was, subpoenaed him up here from the valley where he was on being held on a parole blue warrant, and convinced Chuck Rosenthal's office to recommend to the governor that the man be pardoned. He was eventually pardoned. But he did an extra 3 years, he spent an extra 3 years in prison just because the Court of Criminal Appeals couldn't bring themselves to confront the case until the point where he was about ready to be released on parole anyway. Mm. It's not just the media that don't pay, that until recently hasn't paid much attention to these cases. It's sometimes hard to get the attention of the courts themselves because I guess they have more pressing priorities than the claims of people who are locked up who are innocent. What those priorities might be, I have no idea, but that seems what's the only thing you can conclude.
Well, I've been in the peanut gallery to see some pretty dramatic courtroom footwork. But when you go to appellate court, it's a relatively quiet place.
It is very quiet. I had a case reversed yesterday in the Court of Appeals in Beaumont, a murder case where a woman had self-defense, we think, killed her husband, and the case was reversed because the judge would not give an instruction on self-defense to the jury. So that hopefully will end up with her getting a new trial.
But that's what the option is. They can either try her again or forget the whole thing and say she's been whooped on enough. Uh-huh.
Usually it means a new trial. Now, it's an interesting question about whether the change in the DA's office is going to make any difference. In Dallas, it has made some difference, I think, that there was suddenly a new blood in the office of the district attorney. I know of a case there that was reversed by the U.S. Supreme Court because I was approached about representing the client. I thought when I first looked at it that it was absolutely impossible to save the man from death row. The very clever lawyers in Dallas who ended up representing him discovered a manual where the Dallas District Attorney's Office had the nerve to write down in black and white what steps you take to make sure that no liberals or Jews or blacks were on a jury and how you could get away with it. And after this man
in their manual,
and after this man was put on death row, some guilt-stricken ex-district attorney who still had a copy of the manual turned it over to these lawyers, and they were able to show that those exact techniques had been used in this man's trial to make sure that the jury was made up primarily of people who would be somewhat less likely to have sympathy for him than you might think. His case was reversed by the U.S. Supreme Court. It went back to Dallas, and the new district attorney up there recently agreed that he should be allowed to plead guilty to a life sentence instead of death row. So he'll probably spend most of the rest of his life locked up. But
That's frequently the option, right?
That usually is one of the options when people come back. It's very rare to have someone completely exonerated on a writ. Branley's.
Yeah, I know that we're following. The prison show has been following a case of a young man who, because he was a juvenile, had his sentence commuted to life in prison whenever the Supreme Court said, no, you're not supposed to be killing kids. And so now he's there. The fact that he's innocent is almost not important.
Mm-hmm. it is a victory. I mean, if it's possible, if you can convince the district attorney, as we did recently in a trial case, not to pursue the death penalty, that sometimes is the most relief that you can hope for. If you go to trial and if you can convince a jury not to administer the death penalty, that's considered a lawyer's victory, because in most of these cases, the cases that are chosen to be taken through the very expensive, long and laborious process of a death penalty trial are cases that would just curl your hair. I mean, they are usually the facts are just absolutely horrifying, and should horrify anybody. So the first challenge to a lawyer in capital litigation is try to find some way to convince the jury not to kill your client. And as Jim said earlier, I've run into this many times, is that if you have something, in the old days it would have been retardation. Now that's a pass. But in the old days, if you had something like retardation or a horrible childhood or someone who spent most of his life in some sort of social service institution or another, that evidence, which is called mitigation evidence, is supposed to make your client seem less blameworthy. But as Jim said, many times a jury will hear how much help someone has gotten, and who has ended up killing several people anyway, and it just makes them decide that he's incorrigible, that nothing, that everything's already been done and that nothing can help him, and the only thing that should be done is to put him on death row. So it's another old cliche around the courthouse is that this mitigation evidence is either a two-edged sword, is one way to put it, or else a gun that kicks as hard as it shoots, because it ends up backfiring. You tell the jury all these things that would make many people feel sympathetic, and the jury should get and may look and just decide this is like some dog.
This is a hopeless situation. Let's get rid of it.
Yeah, that's right. That it's hopeless. That's the word for it. Yeah.
And I know this is a personal question, but how are lawyers handling appellate work for indigents compensated?
Well, it depends. There's a standard in Harris County. There's a where lawyers are appointed on an individual basis. I have a private practice. I also do court appointments in these kinds of cases. There is a fee schedule with an hourly rate. If a case is unusually long, it's usually very easy to petition the judge to pay beyond the presumptive maximum. But there are some basic guidelines within which we get paid. In the last few years, the Harris County courts have greatly increased the amount of money being paid to court-appointed lawyers, and they've also greatly increased the requirements to qualify to do court appointments. In the old days, a lawyer could just walk in off the court, drop whatever names he could with a judge and get appointed, and some people swam and some people didn't. Now, there are very strict requirements about past experiences, first-year counsel, and certain quotas about numbers of trials and the seriousness of the offenses of those trials. So it's much more difficult it's now impossible to walk out of law school and decide you want to be a defense lawyer without going and being a prosecutor first, or else being one of that small handful who somehow manages to get a job with the few elite criminal defense lawyers in town. So it's become a much more restrictive world than it was, say, 20 years ago when we had sleeping lawyers and so forth.
Well, it's an unusual business, actually.
Well, yes, it is, I guess, but if you grew up on a diet of Perry Mason, Sherlock Holmes like I did, it just seems like a wonder. It seems like Disneyland sometimes.
Has your practice proven to be as idealistic as your dreams?
Well, I've had, as I said, in 30 years, I've had one case where we actually pulled a Perry Mason and found out who actually committed the offense.
Who done it right there in the courtroom?
I almost got him to confess in court, except the deputy he talked to said the guy who actually was a criminal said, they're just here to find out just to have me talk, right? And the deputy said, no, they're going to prosecute you for it. Well, it was long after the statute of limitations had expired. He couldn't be prosecuted for it, but at that point, he wouldn't say anything. But there was so much evidence that someone else had committed the offense that the district attorney, as I said, recommended that Governor Perry grant him a pardon, and he did, an actual innocence pardon, which is just unbelievably rare.
Well, I think that there's that situation about Henry Lee Lucas. You remember Henry Lee Lucas? Henry Lee Lucas was convicted of killing people all over the country, I mean, literally. And he was about to be executed for killing somebody in Texas, and he had already been convicted of killing somebody 13 minutes before or after in Florida. And so Texas Attorney General Jim Maddox went to talk to him and said, how were you able to go from Florida to Texas in 13 minutes and do this? And Henry said, have you ever seen Star Wars where they stand on this little thing and it goes whir, 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 and off they go? And he said, that's how I get around.
He found a vehicle.
Right. Much to the chagrin of a man who's about to retire as President of the United States, Jim Maddox convinced him to grant Henry Lee Lucas some clemency and turned his sentence into life. They were still afraid to let Henry out, just in case. But Henry died in prison of cancer. We laugh about that, but what if there's somebody out there that has pled guilty and is not, and we've had guests on the prison show that are specialists in that, and a lot of people, not just people with great mental incapacities, mm-hmm. but people with guilt that we don't even know about will plead guilty to something that they did not do, and then that be used by the authorities as evidence to send them to prison for a long time or even kill them, not to mention all those people that don't have enough walking around sense to figure that out. there's a bunch of that out there.
If you go into the system and with thinking that that this doesn't happen and it's being made up by criminals who are in prison and are lying to get out, you're wrong. It does happen. I mean, it's just sometimes inconceivable until you actually start having cases where these kinds of things occur. And it just strains your credulity sometimes. But you're absolutely right. People do confess to things they didn't do.
There was recently a decision by the United States Supreme Court that in a criminal case would allow less than a unanimous jury verdict. So 12 angry men. Henry Ford would not have been able to do it. Is that right?
What happened is a Florida statute. What they basically said that a statute that permits a conviction on 10-2 in felonies and 5-1 in misdemeanors is constitutional. That's what they said. It doesn't say across the board that's true. They just simply said that Florida statute was permissible. I don't know of any statute that permits a 10-2 verdict on a death penalty case. And all that, and I remember, for example, the Supreme Court has also ruled that it's not a requirement to have a jury in a Class C misdemeanor. Because I had people call me, my God, the Supreme Court's abolished juries. That's not true. They simply said a state that passes a statute that permits a 10-2 verdict in a felony is a constitutional statute. That doesn't mean they approve it or disapprove it. But I know of no legislation anywhere that's ever gone up where you can give somebody the death penalty on a 10-2 vote. Usually requires a jury of 12 people to vote.
You can take their liberty.
That's right. And you can take their liberty away on a 10-2 vote. Now, that's just in Florida. And other statutes, like Michigan, may have a 10-2 verdict. And they've talked about in Texas, but Texas is unique in this sense. We have jury punishment. Most states do not have jury punishment. I don't think that's likely to happen here for a while, especially since we now have got some Democrats and the state have got off their butt and started voting. I think it'll change.
Yeah, but, you know, I would feel better about this if there was a good Craig Washington chair of the Criminal Jurisprudence Committee.
Well, you better be glad Obama's going to be put in the next Supreme Court, too. I'll tell you that, Ray.
The election is over, and so is this program. They have executed Elke Lee Taylor tonight. We will be back soon on Execution Watch because George Whitaker is scheduled to be executed this coming Wednesday, and unless he receive a stay. And then there's another one for the end of the week, isn't there? Wednesday and Thursday. For those of you who are listening or who are picking this off the archives, this is Execution Watch. And when Texas executes somebody, we go on the air, HD2 channel on KPFT, or on the Internet via executionwatch.org, kpft.org, theprisonshow.org. There's several ways to get to this program on the Internet, and we encourage you to join us. Every time you hear about Texas having an execution, we will be here. Jim Skelton was with us tonight. Professor Dennis Longmire was reporting from Huntsville. Roland Moore joined us right here in the studio, and you can find out about him at http://RolandMooreLaw.com. And my name is Ray Hill. We are beholden to our worthy producer, Elizabeth Stein. And, of course, none of this would be possible without the electronic wizardry of our own Otis McClay. I'm Ray Hill. Until next week, thank you and good night.
In your mind. foot on Jacob's ladder and one foot in the fire, and it all goes down in your mind. Living at the bottom of the stairs of life, never a smile knocking on your door. The air is blue and so are you, prehistoric monsters on the floor. Last verse of your last song, and God don't hear dead men. The end of the line is in your mind, and you'll be staying in your mind. Heart for heart and soul for soul, somebody said what is true. Lock it up and close it down, the sound of the morning like a dove. High beyond the rattle and roar, look into the face of love.